But tonight we are in chapter 11 of Revelation. Last week we finished up chapter 10. And I said last week that we were in probably one of the more difficult passages. We opened up the seventh seal. We did a little bit of review last week. And we got this strange passage talking about, you know, the angel that is, you know, partly on land, partly on sea. The angel reaches into heaven, and there's this little scroll, and it's speaking to the judgment that we see. There's also a strong connection to Ezekiel. There's a strong connection to early in Ezekiel. Deanne brought it up for us that in Ezekiel chapter 3, we see this little scroll that the Son of Man, Ezekiel, is told to eat. And then we continue in chapter 11 with these connections with Ezekiel. Now, I mentioned this before, but I'll mention it again. When we look at the Old Testament, there is a lot of material that is considered prophecy. And so when I say prophecy, for those listening at home, I'm kind of using air quotes, because there's prophecy that kind of comes in three kinds, more or less three kinds. So there was short-term prophecy, which would be prophecies that the prophets would give that would verify their ability to be a prophet, to speak for the Lord. So when we read the law, God says, look, if somebody claims to be a prophet, somebody claims to speak for Yahweh, test them. They will make short-term predictions to validate that they actually speak for God. Now, why was that the test? Well, because nobody knows the future, right? Anybody who thinks they know the future, you know, tell them to play cattle futures for a while. You know, it's nobody really knows the future. And so people who can accurately predict the future, they can then be trusted, because no one can. So that's something that has to come from God. And so they would make short-term prophecies. The fulfillment of short-term prophecies would be a validation of their ability to speak for God about the law and the interpretation of the law, but also to speak to long-term prophecies. So a famous example would be in Isaiah, right? So we read in Isaiah, the virgin shall conceive. You know, everybody knows that passage. We're in the Christmas season. Everybody's aware of that. But we forget sometimes that that passage did have a short-term prophetic fulfillment then. So if we were to go back to, I think it's Isaiah 7:14, you know, they talk about the young woman shall conceive. They talk about the birth of the child. That was a long-term fulfillment. That was about Christ. But there was a young woman who did give birth. There was a young woman who did give birth at that time. Now, what was it, a virgin who gave birth? No. You could point to a virgin and say, that virgin will give birth. It doesn't mean that she'll be a virgin after she gives birth. And the word virgin can also mean young woman, right? That's a valid thing. So there would be a short-term prophecy that would verify their ability to speak the truth, give commands, tell people how they ought to live, and also to make long-term prophecy. So there's short-term prophecy, long-term prophecy, and then there's another genre of prophecy that a lot of people call apocalypse. So apocalypse is both a kind of prophecy and also a genre of biblical writing. So an apocalypse just means revelation. That's why if you have a Catholic Bible or some versions of the English Bible, instead of the book of Revelation, they'll call it the apocalypse. It comes from the Greek word apokalupto. Apo means from, kalupto means hiding. So when you reveal something, you're taking it from hiding. Apokalupto, apocalypse. This term apocalypse is referring to end times prophecy. End times prophecy, this is just your theology 101 for tonight, means apocalypse is end times prophecy. End times prophecy is apocalypse. And apocalypse is both a kind of prophecy, which is a subset of long-term prophecy. It's a kind of prophecy, and it's also a genre of literature. So there are a couple books in the Old Testament that are considered apocalypses. Zechariah is one of them. Daniel has apocalyptic sections. Zechariah, Ezekiel, Daniel, Joel, portions of Joel are considered apocalyptic. And then, of course, we have the apocalypse, you know, John's apocalypse, right? So is everybody tracking with me so far? Okay, so I keep saying this because it is important. As we study the book of Revelation, everything in the Bible is important. And we have seen over and over and over how important the Exodus is to understanding Revelation. If you want to understand Revelation, you've got to understand the Bible, especially the Old Testament. Understanding the Exodus is really important. But the further we go and the deeper we go into Revelation, the more important it is to understand those apocalyptic prophecies. You know, we talked about, what was that, 3 or 4 weeks ago, we talked about Joel, right, and the plague of locusts, right? We're going to talk about Daniel. I mean, we're going to talk a little bit about Daniel tonight. We're going to talk more about Daniel in the future. Like I said, when we get to the Antichrist, we're probably going to spend several weeks, we're probably going to go through and do a survey of the book of Daniel because it's that important to understand what's going on here. We're not going to do a deep dive into Daniel, but we're going to do a survey, and it'll take us a couple weeks to get through. When we get into the later chapters, we're going to be doing a deep dive into Ezekiel, the later chapters of Ezekiel, but we're going to introduce that tonight. Tonight, we're going to introduce some of that material from Ezekiel. Tonight, we're going to introduce some of that material from Daniel. We're going to look at it. We're not going to go deep tonight, but we need to know what's going on because John keeps pulling from these themes because they're really, really important. So, all that said, I think what we're going to try to do tonight is we're going to try to get to verse 6 because when we get to verse 7, that's when we're going to introduce the beast, we're going to introduce the Antichrist, and then probably after that, it'll be around Christmas time, so we'll have to reevaluate whether people's holidays are going to conflict, and then if we continue to meet when we reconvene, we're going to be diving into Daniel to understand what's happening in verses 7 and following. So, beginning in verses 1, like I said, I think tonight we're going to try to cover verses 1 through 6. Next time we meet, which I think will probably be next week, we'll do verses probably 7 through 9, 7 through 10, maybe a little bit further. And then after that, we're going to be in Daniel for quite a while. So, reading from my translation, "And a rod like a staff was given to me, saying, get up and measure the temple of God and the altar and the ones worshiping in it and the courtyard, the one outside of the temple, cast it outside and you should not measure it because it was given to the nations and the holy city will be trampled 42 months. And I will give to my two testifiers that they will prophesy 1260 days cast about them in sackcloth. These are the two olive trees and the two lampstands, the ones who are standing before before the Lord of the earth. And if someone they wish to unrighteous them, fire comes out from their mouth and eats up their enemies. And if someone they should wish to unrighteous them in this manner, it is necessary for them that they be killed. These have the authority to shut the heaven so that it should not rain in the days of their prophecy, and they have authority upon the waters to turn them into blood and to strike the earth in every plague as often as they should wish." Whew, okay, so we are looking at some of the most, how should I put this? Some of the most contentious verses in Revelation. I know this might seem strange to you, but these are passages that people really really like to fight over. So let's just start with you guys' observations. What do you guys observe? What stands out as being really important to you? He's told to measure the temple, the altar, and it seems like what we would say was probably the main court of the altar. So the temple in the time of Jesus, and actually by the time John writes this, the temple had already been destroyed. John probably writes the Revelation around, people debate this, but most people are going to say that John wrote the Revelation around 90 AD, that it was one of the last things that he wrote. Now, different people dispute that. Different people want to give an early date. Some people want to give a really late date. Some people want to say after 90. Some people want to say, I've heard some people say as early as 60. Like, probably not, but you know, whatever. Because we know that he was on the island of Patmos, right? If we take the internal evidence as being reliable, then it had to happen after he was exiled to Patmos, and that most likely puts it around the year 90 AD. I think some people are really bold, and I think 93 AD is the like really certain date that people can rest their hat on. Okay, whatever. But go ahead. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so yeah, we're definitely going to get that. It's when we mention that it corresponds to the temple. We're going to look at Ezekiel tonight with the Ezekiel temple. But what's interesting is that they measure it, and they measure the altar, they measure the temple itself, they measure the courtyard. Now, the temple in Jesus' day, what's called Herod's temple, which is destroyed by the time John is writing, that is gone. So that's kind of a weird thing that he's talking about measuring a temple. We'll talk about that more in a little bit. But the temple did not have just one outer court. It had two outer courts. They had the main court. So they had the temple structure is, you have the Holy of Holies, where the Ark of the Covenant was. Then you had the holy place, which was where the incense altar, the candelabra, the table for the bread of the presence or the showbread. And then outside of that, you had the altar, the brazen sea. I don't think they had a brazen sea in Herod's day, but they may have made a replica. I don't know enough about it then. But they had like all the other stuff that they would have to slaughter the animals and to skin them and to cook, because not everything was cooked on the altar. Only a small portion of the animals would actually be put on the actual brazen altar. The meat that was cooked, they had lots of cook fires and ways of heating up the meat so that they could bring it back. And they had all this stuff. And then outside of that, they had two courts. They had the court of the Gentiles and the court of the women. Here, he says, you know, the courtyard, the one that's outside of the temple. So this means it's not referring to, the question is it, when it says the courtyard, the one outside the temple, is he referring to the courtyard that would be just the actual courtyard where the altar and stuff is? Or is he talking about the courtyard that would be corresponding to like the court of the Gentiles and the court of the women? Because it's just the courtyard outside of the temple. So when he says outside of the temple, does he mean the temple complex? Meaning the temple, which is the most holy place, the holy place, and then the main courtyard where there was the altar and all the other stuff. So does he mean the temple as in the actual physical structure and everything outside of that is to be excluded? Or does he mean don't measure what would correspond to the court of the women and the court of the Gentiles? Does that make sense? Go ahead, Gene. Yeah, so your question's an excellent question, and it's one that I'm going to propose my answer tonight. But people disagree about this. But yeah, so there are three options, actually. There's the temple in heaven that this could be. I don't think the temple in heaven makes sense because the temple in heaven will not be trampled by the Gentiles, won't be trampled by the nations. So it's probably not that one. So that means, but you're right, that is something that's mentioned in John. I mean, John mentions that in his gospel, or John mentions that in the Revelation, and so it's something we've got to think about. But there are two options that we have, especially when we see the connection to Ezekiel. This could be a temple that has to be rebuilt for logical purposes. If there's going to be an abomination of desolation, which Matthew, Mark, and Luke talk about it, John talks about it in the Revelation, Daniel talks about it when he talks about the king that shall exalt himself. It is clearly mentioned that there is going to be some kind of abominable sacrifice offered in a temple. There is no temple now. So this gives us two options. One, this could give us Ezekiel's, this could be Ezekiel's temple, which is, most people would say, is the millennial temple. That's some people say it's the temple that happens in the New Jerusalem. Some people say it's the millennial temple. We'll get to that later. Not important for right now. But the problem with that is, why would this be the millennial temple? This can't logically be the millennial temple, because the millennial temple, whether it's the millennial temple or the temple in the New Jerusalem, can't happen until after Antichrist is destroyed. And so logically, the only thing that makes sense is this is a temple that has been rebuilt before the rapture or after the rapture, but before the new temple is built during Ezekiel's day. Unless we're to read this as saying that the temple that will be built, that will be used during the days of Messiah, during the millennial reign, will be this temple. The temple that's built then will be that temple. I don't know. That's a really good question, and I don't have a great answer for you. And it's made all the more confusing because there's a clear connection to Ezekiel here. You can't miss the connection to chapters 40 and following of Ezekiel. It's too on the nose to miss. And so, yeah, we're gonna come back to that when we go through verse by verse. Does anybody have anything they want that really stands out to them in verses 3 through 6, or anything that we haven't talked about yet in verses 1 and 2? Yes. There is definitely a connection in this passage to in Zechariah where they're talking about Zerubbabel and Joshua the high priest. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, when we get there, we're definitely going to go back to Zechariah and we're going to look at that passage. But again, I mean, we're getting kind of this swirl of apocalyptic literature where it's really hard to follow and say, oh, well, we need to just like, you know, earlier in Revelation, we would say, man, all of this is copying Exodus. And we would have big chunks where we're just talking about Exodus comparisons. Now, I mean, it's Ezekiel, Daniel, Zechariah, maybe some Isaiah here. We're seeing all of these ideas. Actually, there is Isaiah. We're seeing, and the Exodus as well. We're seeing all of these ideas really start to swirl together. And the question is, when ideas swirl together like that, when biblical references really like they're used fast and furious, does that change the importance that we put on those Old Testament prophecies, the Old Testament material? So the reason I bring it up is this. When Paul quotes one passage of the Old Testament in one of the sermons he gives, or when Peter quotes one passage, you know, we talked about it Sunday. You know, Peter is quoting from Psalm 2, or the people praying are quoting from Psalm 2. Clearly that's significant. But what do you do when you look at a passage like Romans 1 or Romans, is it Romans 1 or Romans 3, or other places where you just see passage after passage after passage after passage where the writer is quoting these things and using phraseology from the Bible? Are we supposed to let the Old Testament understanding of that control how we interpret in the New Testament? Or do we just say he's borrowing imagery from the Old Testament and he's just using that for power? We don't actually need to go back and understand the Old Testament context. Does that make sense, my question? Just to reiterate, when do we know when we need to go back and really understand the context of something, and when is it just they're using phrases and ideas that were built into people's imagination because it was convenient, and you don't need to go back and understand every little thing? That's a live question in biblical interpretation. It's not a question that's been settled. And the question is that what's happening here, or do we actually need to go back and carefully look at every reference that John is making, because John is carefully selecting every one of these references? I have my opinion on that. I'll let you guys think through that, and if you have answers, go ahead. But anything else that we see in this passage that really stands out to you? We will talk about who the witnesses are, the testifiers, but we will answer why 1260 days when we get to the verse by verse study. But yes, excellent point. Great question. Anything else?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yeah, great point. That's definitely something that stands out. I mean, this is definitely everything here is really powerful and important. So there's no fluff passages here in this section of Revelation. Everything stands out. So we go to verse 1. A rod like a staff was given to me, saying, get up and measure the temple of God and the altar and the ones worshiping in it, etc., etc., etc. So let's go to Ezekiel. And let's go. Whoops, I went way past it. So we're going to go. We're passing chapter 39, and we're starting in chapter 40. And on April 28th, this New Living actually gives us the Julian calendar version of this. That's convenient. The Lord took me in a vision. God took me to the land of Israel, and he set me down on a very high mountain. From there, I could see what appeared to be a city across from me toward the south. He brought me near. I saw a man whose face shone like bronze standing beside a gateway entrance. He was holding in his hand a measuring tape and a measuring rod. He said to me, son of man, watch and listen. Pay close attention to everything I show you. You have been brought here so that I can show you many things. Then you will return to the people of Israel and tell them everything you had seen. And I could see a wall completely surrounding, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to read, you know, all of this passage. But what do? They go and they measure the temple. They go and they measure the temple. Ezekiel gives us detailed dimensions of what this temple and the temple complex is going to be. So let me ask the obvious question. Why? why is Ezekiel giving us these detailed instructions about the layout of this temple? That's possible. That's definitely an option. It's something that will be destroyed and have to be rebuilt. I mean, the temple has been destroyed. So are these instructions that careful readers are supposed to say, yes, when we rebuild the temple, when the Jews rebuild the temple, we need to build them to these specifications? I would assume that any Jew who wants to be part of, because there is a plan to rebuild the temple. There are a lot of Jews who very desperately, if they can ever get by with it, they will rebuild the temple on the Temple Mount. They want to very badly. Because for them, the fact that they are existing without a sacrificial system, without a Levitical priesthood, is deeply, deeply grievous. And so there are a lot of Jews who definitely want to rebuild the temple complex. So that is option one. These are the dimensions of the temple that will be rebuilt either before or during the tribulation period, but does not exist now. The other option is, this is a temple that will be built during the millennium or during the New Jerusalem, depending on how you interpret that. You want to say something, Deanne? I would guess that yes, that they would look at that, and they would definitely interpret this as a future temple, because they didn't have a temple in Ezekiel. Well, they did have a temple in Ezekiel's day, but the temple was going to be destroyed. So I think that they would have seen that. And when we get to verse 43, we see in chapter 43, verse 2, suddenly the glory of the God of Israel appeared from the east. The sound of his coming was like the roar of rushing waters, and the whole landscape shone with his glory. The vision was just like other things that he had seen. And when we look at chapter 44, we see that there is going to be a special relationship that the prince has to this land. Now, in Ezekiel's day, they did still have a prince. They still had a priesthood. They still had a puppet ruler. That puppet ruler was going to be deposed. But again, in Ezekiel's immediate context of Ezekiel, they could have maybe interpreted this as applying to them. I don't think it did, because this wouldn't have matched I don't believe this would have matched the dimensions of the temple that existed, of Solomon's temple. But they would have said, well, maybe it's going to be rebuilt during our day. They didn't necessarily know. But somebody reading Ezekiel carefully, and maybe not carefully, somebody reading Ezekiel chronologically would assume that this temple maybe is built after chapters 36 through 39, the restoration of Israel, the Valley of Dry Bones, the War of Gog and Magog, and the slaughter of Gog's armies. So that maybe they believe that this will happen after there is some great world conflict. It will just depend on how you read that. I tend to think that we should read it in that sense, that there will be a great world conflict, and maybe this won't be built then, but that's when the glory of the Lord is going to return to this temple. That's when the prince is going to enter this temple. So, but again, the question comes back to us, what are we supposed to do with this? First of all, why is John even mentioning this? I think that's absolutely true. God, when he wants things built, gives very specific instructions. You mentioned Noah, great point. We look here in Ezekiel. They're very clear dimensions. So that's certainly part of it. But it's interesting that John doesn't rehearse the dimensions. John doesn't tell us what the dimensions are. He simply tells us that he was supposed to go and measure it, and he was supposed to measure everything, and he was supposed to then exclude the outer court, whatever that is, or whatever is outside the outside of the temple. Whatever that is, he's not supposed to measure that. So what's the point? Why does he mention this? Is this just a jumping off place to get to the trampling, the 42 months of trampling? Or is there a specific reason why he's mentioning this temple? Does anybody have any theories, any thoughts? All right, so I guess I'll just throw this out here, and you can do with it what you want. But my thought is that this is mentioned because he wants us to start thinking that something apocalyptic is coming. John wants us to remember what's happening in Ezekiel. He wants us to remember that in Ezekiel, this is a temple with restored glory. That connection, there's a connection to a temple that is going to have glory in it. It's a connection to a temple that is that exists after the armies arrayed against Israel are destroyed. But it seems like it's not yet. It seems like there's a disconnect between what's happening in Ezekiel and what's happening here in Revelation. So like I said, you've got a couple options. One, you've got the option that this is the temple was built during the tribulation or shortly before it, and it continued. That's the temple that continues to be used during the millennial reign. Or John is doing something different and simply saying that maybe he's saying that this is a temple that is both like and unlike that temple. So it's going to be like that temple because it's going to be a temple in Jerusalem and it's going to be designed for sacrifice, but it won't be the real temple. It won't be the actual temple of the prince. It won't be the actual temple that the glory of God comes upon. So you could go either way with that, and I don't think you'd be really hard pressed to make a case for either one of those. I tend to think, this is just my opinion, and so I very easily could be wrong, but I tend to think that what's happening here is he's telling us that there is a connection. He wants us to start thinking in the mode of end times. Now, the whole book of Revelation is already about end times, but I think he's trying to draw us in, and he's saying there's something very significant about this temple. There's something very significant about the timing of this. He wants us to think in that whole mode of Ezekiel. So he's not saying something specific. He's not trying to make a specific put your finger on the verse point, but he wants us to be thinking about everything around there. And he's talking about the temple. Why? Because something very important in Revelation is going to happen at the temple. Important things are going to happen there. And so we need to know, like Gene pointed out, one, there's going to be a temple. There's going to be a temple during the tribulation period. Two, it's going to be trampled by the Gentiles. So we look here and then we see, you know, that it's going to be given to the nations. It's going to be given to the Gentiles, and the holy city is going to be trampled for 42 months. So 42 months is a really interesting length of time. It's 3.5 years. Okay, so where have we seen 3.5 years? We're going to see it again in Revelation, but we've seen it in Daniel, right? We've seen this material in Daniel, and it's really important. Now, if we go to the end of Daniel, the very end, we see chapter 12, verse 11. From the time the daily sacrifice is taken away, and the sacrilegious object that causes desecration is set up to be worshipped, there will be 1,290 days, and blessed are those who wait and remain until the end of 1,335 days. As for you, go your way until the end. You will rest, and then at the end of the days, you will rise again to receive the inheritance set aside for you. Okay, so those numbers don't really match. But we do have, what, time, times, and half a time, right? So we go ahead, Dan, you were going to say something. Okay, yeah. So what we have is at the end of Daniel, we've got these kind of hard-to-follow arguments. We've got the 70 weeks of Daniel. And the 70 weeks of Daniel are very fascinating. There is, I think we'll spend more time in the 70 weeks of Daniel when we're doing our kind of survey of the book of Daniel. But it's important to understand that these are things that are clearly being mentioned. These are things that are clearly being drawn upon by John. And he's saying that these guys are going to prophesy for 1,260 days. Not 1,290 days, not 1,335 days. They're going to prophesy for 1,260 days. That's really interesting. Because it doesn't match a number that we have before. And 42 months, it does match the 42 months, which is, you know, 3.5 years. It does match the 1,260 days, if we're assuming a 30-day month, which, you know, maybe they did, maybe they didn't. But if we look at that, we're going to say, okay, this is about 3.5 years. So they're going to prophesy. So the holy city is going to be trampled for 42 months. The holy city is going to be trampled for 3.5 years. The holy city is going to be trampled for time, times, and half a time. Clear connection to Daniel. Can't miss that. Then we see that there are going to be two witnesses, and they're going to prophesy for 1260 days, and they're going to be clothed in sackcloth. Okay, why sackcloth? Why is that significant? For mourning? Yep, because sackcloth is significant of mourning. Now, this is strange, though, because when we've seen believers, how have they been dressed so far in Revelation? Yeah, they've been dressed in white. They've been dressed in white because the white stands for the purity of the children of God, for the servants of God. So these guys are dressed differently. They're not dressed in white. They're dressed in clothes of mourning. And these are two olive trees and the two lampstands, the ones who are standing before the Lord of the earth. Okay, so wait a second. We've now got to try to wrangle with Ezekiel, mentioning the reference to Ezekiel chapter 39 through 44 of Ezekiel with the measuring of the temple. Then we see that we've got the 70 weeks of Daniel that we have to try to balance. Now they talk about, you know, this lampstand. So if we go to Zechariah, if you go to Malachi, you've gone too far. If you go to Matthew, you've gone way too far. Okay, so we see here that there is, in chapter 4, the angel who was talking with me returned and woke me as though I had been asleep. What do you see now? He asked. I see a solid gold lampstand with a bowl of oil on top of it. Around the bowl are seven lamps, each one having seven spouts with wicks, and I see two olive trees, one on each side of the bowl. Then I asked the angel, what are these, my lord? What do they mean? Don't you know? The angel asked. No, my lord, I replied. Then he said to me, this is what the Lord says to Zerubbabel. It is not by power nor by might, but by my spirit, says the Lord Almighty. Nothing, not even a mighty mountain, will stand in Zerubbabel's way. It will flatten out before him. Then Zerubbabel will set a final stone of the temple in place. Wait, what's he going to do? Then Zerubbabel will set the final stone of the temple in place, and the people will shout, may God bless it, may God bless it. Then another message came to me from the Lord. Zerubbabel is the one who laid the foundation of this temple, and he will complete it. Then you will know that the Lord Almighty has sent me. Do not despise these small beginnings, for the Lord rejoices to see the work begin, to see the plumb line in Zerubbabel's hand. For these seven lamps represent the eyes of the Lord. Oh, wait, haven't we already seen the seven eyes of the Lord? Okay, so we've seen that. That search all around the world. Then I asked the angel, what are these two olive trees on each side of the lampstand, and what are the two olive branches that pour out golden oil through the two gold tubes? Don't you know? He asked. No, my lord, I replied. Then he said to me, they represent the two anointed ones who will assist the Lord of all the earth. Okay, now, if Zechariah weren't hard enough to understand to begin with, now we see that not only is this a near-term prophecy about Zerubbabel, but this also seems to be a long-term prophecy about something that's going to happen later. It would certainly appear that there is an unmistakable connection to the temple that was built in the days of Zechariah. Right? Zechariah was there. He was one of the people who returned, and they rebuilt the temple. Zerubbabel was the governor appointed by the Persians, and they rebuilt the temple. And Zechariah is promising, and somebody mentioned Joshua, Zerubbabel and Joshua. Okay, Deanne mentioned that. So we're going to see that. Joshua, interestingly, was the high priest, and he was the one who was clothed in filthy garments, and Satan came to accuse him, and they said, take off his filthy garments, put on clean garments, and then he's going to be made ready to serve as a priest. So Zerubbabel, who's incidentally in the genealogy of Jesus, was a descendant of David. He was made the governor. He was kind of a king, but he was there for the laying the foundation and laying the capstone on a rebuilt temple. Now we have a measuring of a temple. We have a rebuilding of a temple. We have this messianic prophecy about the end of days, about this temple that's going to return. And now we have these witnesses, these two olive trees and two lampstands that are standing before the Lord of all the earth. Now wait, again, who are they? Well, it says in verse 14 of Zechariah 4, they represent the two anointed ones who assist the Lord of all the earth. Thanks, Zechariah. That is really helpful. Does that clarify anything for you? Because that does not help me even a little bit, right? Does not help me at all. But here's what we do know. So let's stop and let's think about what we do know. We do know that lampstands were very important. Golden lampstands were very important in the theology of Israel. They were symbolic of the light. People have said that light was the ultimate expression of deity to the Israelite mind. So the Romans spoke about glory, the Greeks spoke about wisdom, and the Jews spoke about light. To them, light was the ultimate expression of what God is. He is the revealer of things. He is the one who inspires knowledge and truth, light. So the golden lampstand represents divine presence. And how were those lampstands fueled? They were fueled by oil. Oil is a clear representation of the Holy Spirit in the Bible. But here in Zechariah, it's one olive tree fueling two lampstands, and the two lampstands are the assistants. Here in Zechariah, we have two olive trees and two lampstands. So are there two Holy Spirits? Are there two? But the olive trees and the lampstands seem to be united. They seem to be treated as the same persons, as the same people. And we'll see more in a second. So what's going on here? What are we to make of this? Because this is, again, this is not easy stuff. What are we to make of this? It seems to me that if you guys have another idea, you got something you want to throw out there, please do. It seems to me that the imagery hasn't changed. The olive tree still represents the Holy Spirit, but the Holy Spirit is dwelling within these witnesses. It's symbolic imagery. I think what it's saying, what John is saying is, these guys, these two witnesses, are so full of the Holy Spirit that they're described as being one with the image for the Holy Spirit. They are so full of oil, so full of this productive material that it just overflows. So they can be identified with an image for the Holy Spirit, which is pretty powerful. I mean, theologically, I could write a paper on that, and I bet there would be five people at least who would read it, right? So we could, that was supposed to be a joke, But what do we do with this? What's this all about? What are we supposed to do with this? What do these guys do? Well, John's telling us. If we go back to Zechariah and try to figure out what Zechariah is telling us, Zechariah doesn't know. Zechariah is looking at this prophecy from 2,000 years before. He's seeing this in a great distance. John is getting the clarification. So this is one of those places where we can't look back to the Old Testament prophecy To clarify what John's saying. John is saying, no, I'm going to clarify Old Testament prophecy for you. What Ezekiel couldn't make clear, I'm going to make clear for you. What Daniel couldn't make clear, I'm going to make clear for you. What Zechariah couldn't make clear, I'm going to make clear for you. He unites these passages, and then we can retroactively go back and look into Zechariah, Ezekiel, Daniel, Isaiah, Exodus, and we can make sense of what's there that was confusing before. Does that make sense? So what we're doing here is we're going to say, okay, so what do we know about this? How does that inform what we know about that? And then how does that, they call it the hermeneutical spiral. And then how does what we know about Zechariah, Daniel, Ezekiel, Isaiah, Exodus, then Joel inform what we see in Revelation? It's a spiral. The circle is never unbroken. But we see that they're serving the Lord somehow. How are they serving the Lord? Well, it appears if Zechariah is helpful, if we can use Zechariah as a standard, they are going to prophesy and they're going to assist whoever is rebuilding the temple. They're going to stand for God in whoever's rebuilding the temple. If we can rely on Zechariah, can we rely on Zechariah? I don't know. I honestly don't. But what we do know is they're servants of the Lord. We do know that they are going to be servants of the Lord who are there while the temple is rebuilt. Again, if we can rely on Zechariah. And they are going to prophesy and speak to the people. Now, what's their message going to be? We don't know, but people don't like it. Whatever their message is, it's not popular because people want to harm them. And when people want to harm them, what comes out? Fire. Fire comes out from their mouth and it eats up their enemies. What does that remind us of? What does that remind you guys of? Yeah, what does the fire coming out of the mouth remind you of?
Any thoughts? Anything that stands out to you guys with? Well, let's continue on. Maybe it'll clear up a little bit. So they call fire, and by the way,
I'll just make this real quick. Remember who wrote this book. Remember who wrote John. Remember his history. So something interesting there. And if someone should wish to harm them, it is in this manner, it is necessary for them that they be killed. So you see my footnote in verse 48. The Greek is, you cannot translate this literally into English. It's a really difficult passage. It's languages are like that sometimes where there's literally no way to literally translate this into English. I spent a lot of time on this verse trying to figure out how to render this. It's just a difficult passage. But they're saying it's necessary for them to be killed. They have to die this way. Why do they have to die this way? Because there's something significant. There's something symbolic and meaningful about the way that they die. But then we also see they have the authority to shut what? They have the authority to shut heaven. They have the authority to shut heaven. What does that remind us of? Yeah, I mean, to me, that's we go to 1 Kings 17. I love how Elijah just walks onto the pages of Scripture. Now, Elijah, who's from Tishbe in Gilead, told King Ahab, "As surely as the Lord, the God of Israel lives, the God whom I worship and serve, there will be no dew or rain during the next few years unless I give the word." So whoever this is, whoever this witness is, has a clear connection to Elijah. So much of a connection that a lot of people think it is Elijah. Because remember, Elijah didn't die. Elijah was taken up alive. Elijah and Enoch are great pictures of a pre-tribulational rapture because they're people that never died. They were taken away by the Lord. And so Elijah never died, but Elijah goes, and whether this is actually the literal Elijah or not, I don't think matters. He's coming in the spirit and the power of Elijah. What do we know about the person who comes in the spirit and power of Elijah? That's who comes to prepare the way for Christ. Now, Jesus said, yeah, John the Baptist is Elijah, if you can accept it. In a certain way, he was the Elijah who was to come. But there is another Elijah who is to come. There's another Elijah who's to come. And so John was a short-term fulfillment of that. There's going to be a long-term fulfillment of this Elijah who comes to prepare the way for the Lord. And what they do is they have authority so that it shouldn't rain, these two. And they have authority upon the earth to turn the waters into blood and to strike the earth with every plague as often as they should wish. Now, who does that remind us of? Yeah, it reminds us of the Exodus. Why does it remind you of the Exodus? Exactly. So we see this connection with Moses. Moses was the one who turned the water into blood. Moses was the one who brought back the plagues. Now remember, I told you guys a couple weeks ago that I translate that word plague very literally because I want us to make that connection. John wants us to make the connection with the plagues of Egypt as well. He wants us to see that. Why are we making connections with the plagues of Egypt? Well, we're going to see in the future, we're going to see, and by in the future I mean when we get to verses 7 and following, there's a connection to Egypt. What's the connection to Egypt? Egypt has a lot of symbolic meaning. It has a lot of weight in biblical theology. What is Egypt? It's a land of slavery. So when we're in the book of Exodus, see, this is another thing that you have to pay attention to. Sometimes in the Bible, things can mean more than one thing. Something could be symbolic of something in one place and symbolic of something else in another place. So in Exodus, as we look at it through a Christian lens, as we interpret the book of Exodus through the lens of Christianity, we see that the Exodus is a picture of people who are leaving slavery to sin. It's a picture of salvation. That's what the Exodus is. It's a picture of salvation. Christ's fulfillment of the Passover makes that crystal clear. Jesus is our Passover lamb. I mean, the Bible just tells us that, right? The Bible itself tells us, look, you want to know how to interpret the Exodus. The Exodus is salvation. So Egypt, by extension, Egypt then is symbolic of the world. Egypt is symbolic of us being in sin. Egypt is symbolic of our lost estate that we have to leave our birth in Adam, and we have to leave and go to the promised land, right? Later, Egypt is symbolic of what? It's symbolic of people wanting to return to the world, because when we get to the later parts of the Exodus, after they've already got out, what do they want to do? They want to keep going back to Egypt. Well, does that mean you can lose your salvation? No, that's not what it's pointing to. It's saying that there is an allure that the world has. So early in Exodus, Egypt stands for being lost. Later in Exodus, Egypt stands for the world. Later in the Bible, Egypt is going to be a place where Jesus escapes to. And so the symbolism of Egypt changes. So we have to try to figure out, what is it symbolizing? What's going on? What's happening? And that's not always an easy thing to do. So that's one of those things that you have to balance when you talk about certain symbols. Some symbols in the Bible are really clear what they mean. They mean one thing and one thing only, and the meaning never really changes throughout the Bible. Egypt is one of those, like water, where some symbols have a lot of different uses. They have a lot of different meanings. They mean different things to different authors, and we need to be careful of that. But the plagues of Egypt here, John has been using the plagues pretty reliably to mean one thing, which is that God is punishing those who reject Christ. When he uses the plagues, it is very similar to the way that the plagues of Egypt were used in the book of the Exodus. There are people who are opposed to God, the world system, the rulers of the world, they are opposed to God, and they refuse to bend the knee, they refuse to obey God, and God keeps striking them with plagues until they either obey or die. That's the way God is handling this. He's saying obey or die. So we've got Moses, and we've got Elijah. Why these two people? Remember, and I mentioned it Sunday, I was hoping that somebody would mention it, but in 2 Kings chapter 1, Elijah, what does he do? Dan got it finally. Yeah, Elijah calls down fire from heaven on those 50 men. Remember who wrote the Revelation? John, who wanted to burn up the city. You know, he wanted to call down fire from heaven. So the sons of thunder wanted to do that, right? So, but why, if these are representative, if Moses and Elijah are the representatives that we should see in this passage, why Moses and Elijah? Why those two? Why are they the models for who these people are? And why specifically Moses and Elijah in these contexts? Because Moses did a lot of stuff. Elijah did a lot of stuff. Why Moses and Elijah, specifically in the context of Moses with the plagues? That he could have given us a lawgiver, Moses, if he wanted to tell us it was Moses, but he didn't. He gives us Moses, the plague bringer. And they give us Elijah, the fire from heaven caller downer. Why? And Elijah, the heaven shutter. Why that version of Elijah, and why those two people?
What do you think, Gene?
Yeah. Moses and Elijah are the two that were there on the Mount of Transfiguration. So that, and by the way, John was a witness of that. So it would seem significant. And I think that's what a lot of people go to. A lot of people point that out, that Moses and Elijah were there. I think there's something else going on here too. And just, again, this is just my theory. This could be completely wrong. But what we see here is Moses and Elijah, first of all, there are not two bigger names in Judaism than Moses and Elijah. I mean, it's a pretty tight-knit group of the big names in Bible history, but really, you don't get bigger than Moses and Elijah. I mean, maybe you want to throw David and Abraham in there, and they can hold their own with these guys, and they do, but nobody's more important than Moses and Elijah. But Moses and Elijah are in specific contexts here. This isn't Moses the deliverer. This is Moses the plague bringer. This isn't Elijah the person who brings Israel back to God. This is Elijah who shuts the heavens, and people are suffering in drought, trying to bring the king to their knees. Think about that context. In both events, in Moses bringing the plagues, Elijah shutting down the heaven, what was the purpose? The purpose of that was to create a confrontation between a pagan king and God himself. In both instances, the conflict was between Pharaoh and God, Yahweh, Ahab and God, Yahweh. Now, with Elijah, it was via a confrontation with Baal, right? But with Moses, they talk about a judgment of the pagan gods. Remember that God says, I will judge the gods of Egypt when he brings the Passover, when the death angel comes through. So what I think we're supposed to see here is whoever these prophets are, whatever they're doing, it is creating a open confrontation between the rulers of the world and God himself. It is not hidden. It is not ignored. It is a clear and open confrontation between them. And then what are we going to see in verse 7? Well, the beast coming out of the abyss will make war with them, the two witnesses, and kill them. Hold on. Was Moses killed by Pharaoh? No. Was Elijah killed by Ahab? I mean, he ran away from Jezebel, but she didn't catch him, right? So was Elijah killed? No. Elijah calls down fire from heaven, I mean, which is even mentioned right here. Nobody killed Elijah. Nobody killed Moses. People wanted to real bad, but they didn't. But here, these guys are going to get killed by whom? By the great world ruler, by the beast who is coming up out of the abyss. So we've got a broken pattern. Now, I don't want to get too much ahead of next week's passage, but this is, there's something really, really important going on, and I don't know that John is entirely clear about what it is here. John wants us, I think what John is doing here is telling us all that stuff you've read, everything you've read in Ezekiel, Daniel, Zechariah, the Kings, the Exodus, Isaiah, because we do have some oblique references, at least oblique references here to Isaiah. All those things you've read, they're all coming to fruition. All the apocalyptic material you've read, it's all coming together here. And I think what John is doing, and again, like maybe you're going to read a commentary and they're going to explain every one of these things verse by verse, and you're going to say, I agree 100%. Luke, you just need to be bold and say what you think it means. I don't know, maybe. I think what John is doing here is he's telling us, think about these things. Think about the temple. Think about Zechariah. Think about the coming king. Think about Daniel's 42 weeks and the great world ruler who is going to arise, who is going to oppose God. Think about the abomination of desolation. Think about Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Think about the end times prophecies. I want you thinking about all that stuff. Why? Because I'm going to explain it. I think John is trying to draw from all of these things, and he's setting the stage. I mentioned last week, it's almost like an overture, right? The overture tells you the musical themes that you're going to hear so that you know what to expect later in a musical or an opera. This is almost like an overture. He's saying, listen, oh, can you hear the brass? The brass that's telling us Ezekiel? Oh, listen to the strings. The strings are lifting up Moses. So we hear all this stuff, and then as we continue through, we're going to know that John is going to explain this material in the past. Don't look for a complete explanation here. That's one of the big mistakes people do when you read through Revelation, especially if you're going to go through Revelation verse by verse, is you're trying to find an explanation right here in this text. John doesn't do that. That's not how wisdom literature works. John, a lot of times, doesn't give us the explanation until the end of the book. Remember, there's stuff in chapter 1 that we don't really understand until we get to chapter like 19 or 20, right? That's not how John works. Don't think that everything's going to be explained right here. Sometimes you just have to wait and be patient, which is kind of ironic that in the book about the future that hasn't come true for 2,000 years, one of the lessons we learn in learning how to interpret the book is that sometimes you have to be patient. Anyways, I could go on with that, but I won't. Anyways, go ahead. Mm-hmm. I think that shut off heaven at that point does not mean shut off the ability for people to ascend to be with God. I think it means it's a euphemism, or not a euphemism, it's a figure of speech for there will be no rain. I think, and he explains it there where he says, so that it should not rain in the days of these prophecies. So verse 6, that's verse 6. I'm trying to... Yeah, it's a hina clause. Hina in Greek means so that. So they're gonna shut the heavens so that it shouldn't rain. Yeah. It's not referring to. I mean, that's a really good question. It's not referring to people being precluded from entering heaven, but it's referring to the actual. It's using the heavens as a figure of speech. Any other final observations or questions or stuff that you guys want to talk about tonight? I feel kind of bad. The last couple weeks, I feel like we've walked away with a lot more questions than answers. But so if you're a person that doesn't like walking away with more questions than answers, I'm sure these have been some difficult Bible studies. But yeah, like I said, next week, which will be the 15th, and probably that'll be our last. I don't know what you guys think. Do you guys want to meet on the 22nd, or do you guys just want to wait until maybe after the new year? You don't have to answer now. We'll think about it next week. We'll talk about it, and because you guys are the ones that come. I'd like to get more people coming, but we'll talk about it. But yeah, so next week we will cover chapter 7, verse 7 through, we might get all the way to 13. Probably we'll cover 13, and then after that, whenever we meet again, whether it's the 22nd or whether it's the 29th or whether it's the, what would that be, the 5th or the 6th of January, whatever that date happens to be, then we're going to start going through Daniel. So if you guys want to get ahead, start working ahead, maybe start working through, reading through Daniel a little bit, because we're going to spend some time there. But anyways, that's all I got for everybody. Thank you guys. Thank you for your participation. The less I talk, the more fun it is for me.